So the rest of the landscape of what I'm going to offer this morning is how do we come into being, where have we been, where are we going, as far as I understand it, the present moment. And then all the international gatherings recently have given me a whole new piece in our unfoldment. So then the last part I'll introduce what I call the Rosary of the Good Seeds, which is the practice that came for this one. How do we come into being formally? When it became evident that I was not the person to lead the Guild for Spiritual Guidance in its next generation of Christian spiritual guidance, John Youngblood said to me, "That's because you're supposed to create your own." Now, here again I was confronted with the question, why me? Why me? Create something on your own? So every once in a while I would think about it, and I didn't really pay much attention to it. And we moved to England for a couple of years, and when we got there, John had Parkinson's. That's why they were looking for a replacement. And he wrote to me in the last couple months of his life. And he said, "I'm writing to remind you that you have something to create. You have a calling to create your own unique form for spiritual guidance." And then he told me something he had never told me before. I first met him at a luncheon years before I studied with him. And I went to the luncheon because the luncheon actually was for John to meet a friend of mine. And he said to me, "At the luncheon, I knew it was you I was supposed to meet, not the friend that the luncheon was arranged for." So I want to really leave you with this last piece. You have something to create, something to do that will be your unique form. Now, that letter coming from him, that he took that amount of time, he had lost a leg at this point, it was a very difficult life, that he took that amount of time to write that to me, I realized was very important. And really, within 2 weeks, the whole format of the initial training came, and I was finishing the last piece in an airplane on the way to Bremen, Germany, where I was teaching a course in transpersonal psychology. I got off the plane, and the people, Diana and Tonson, such beautiful people, looked at me and saw something was going on, and they said, "What's happening?" And I told them the initial piece, the different topics, this format of it, and they said to me, "We will do it." And right then and there, it got the step toward manifestation. They organized the first program. It was in Bremen, Germany. We did 3 more there. I never ever imagined it would extend to 5 countries, and over 30 different groups have gone through it. We have 3 people here from the newest one that just started, literally 10 days ago in Vancouver in Hollyhock. So that was when it got really articulated, and still I struggled with, who, me? You know, you have to realize from my perspective, my teachers are huge figures, and they are huge figures. You know, Reb Zalman created a whole new branch of Judaism, introduced spiritual eldering as a whole theme. Pir Vilayet took a universal Sufism and spread it throughout the world and put it in contemporary language. It spoke to a whole new generation and created Omega Institute and created interfaith dialogues on a whole different level. And Francis Vaughan is one of the founders of transpersonal psychology. These are, you know, really vast contributors. So my sense was always, compared to them, who, me? And it was only because John really took that time at the end of his life to write that. I felt there was something he needed to complete to tell me. That was my faith to go forward. And then when I did go to Pir Vilayet, because I didn't want a lot of confusion in the Sufi order about what I was doing, Pir Vilayet listened to me and he said, "Atum, it's the message, not the order," meaning it's that larger consciousness. And he said to me, do it on your own. You'll be free to do it your way. Now I went to see him several years later, after the school had started to unfold. And he said to me, Atum, you were so wise you did it on your own. He said to me, and I felt the depth of it. He said, I wish I could have done that. He gave me the freedom because he also knew what it was like to have an established structure that may not be fully yours. So that was an enormous blessing. And then I found out only later, years later, that Reb Zalman went to Pir Vilayet and said to Pir Vilayet, let him go. Let him go. He has his own work. Let him go. So these were all pieces I had no idea were moving behind the scenes as I tried to unfold it. And still, you know, then people would, I would hear rumors, well, Atum has really left the Sufi order because he's starting his own school. And that word was like, ah, run as far as you can. Who am I to start my own school? I mean, these are traditions. No, really, it was, and people would, I heard people, or they would say that, and there was such a panic in me. And then one day, I was with my good friend Taj, and we were talking about the spiritual guidance program, and she said, it's a school. I mean, she said it so... There's something about the way she said it, and I was all of a sudden, oh yeah, it is a school. It is a school. It's all there. I mean, it's there. She was just naming what was there, and it popped something in me. Now, what do you need for a school? You need the same things that Buddha mentioned. You need the Buddha, meaning a teacher. You need a Dharma, a path to teach, and you need a community. Now, one of the times, at a certain stage in Pure Vilayet's life, he used to say, I am a transitional figure. And I always remembered that. He said, in the future there won't be gurus. I'm a transitional figure. And really, I think, he said, what will be the... replace it will be transpersonal psychologist. You know, and so I ended up really being mentored by Francis Vaughan in that field. And Reb Zalman said, your generation knows something. You know how to put the robe on and you know how to take it off. The earlier generations wore the robe all the time. So if they were doing something simple, when you saw a picture of them, it was always great man doing something simple. But your generation knows much more how to integrate the place of service, the role of service, and how to take it off appropriately for your own human life and journey. So I'm just going to go through, because Hazrat Inayat Khan said, when something has been accomplished, you need to always stop and acknowledge the accomplishment. Because in that acknowledgement, the soul becomes aware of its power to manifest. It has enormous power, but it's not necessarily aware of it. And he also said it builds self-confidence in the ego, in its capacity to support the dreams of the soul. So I'm just going to mention what many of us in this room have journeyed through. And I think of the courses as the inner pilgrimages. We have the outer pilgrimages and we have the inner pilgrimages. And the courses are the inner pilgrimage to certain archetypes. So just listen to the archetypal worlds that you have made a pilgrimage to. The call and discernment. Prayer. Myth, God images and ideals, shadow and idealism, typology and the spiritual path, the world of creative imagination, including dreams. stages and states on the spiritual journey. Four worlds of the soul. The archetypal relationship in five different dimensions of the seeker and the guide. In a deep process of completion. That's our agenda for the spiritual guidance program. The alchemical operations of transformation, Narli did an exquisitely beautiful, distillated presentation of those last night. Salutio, calcinatio, coagulatio, sublimatio, separatio, conjunctio, mortificatio. The journey through those amazing worlds. And as Jung said, they are around us all the time, everywhere. And what I so love is the people who've done the alchemical process have experienced it deeply enough that they see it everywhere. It has become a part of our dialogue. It's become a part of our recognition of where we are, of where other people are. It has been lived. That's what makes it so beautiful for me. And then the archetypes. Now, the deep question that I had, in addition to who am I, is what's our lineage? Because every path that I know of has a lineage. And we have a certain level of lineage, which are the teachers that I have mentioned for me, but many of you have not had the opportunity to meet them. And some of them have passed on. Where is the lineage for our particular way forward? And it came, but I didn't realize the answer for a while. Our lineage is the eight archetypes in the Essential Archetypes program. And those eight archetypes are found in every great tradition. They're embodied by different figures like Mary and Kuan Yin and Christ and Guru Rinpoche and etc. They're in every tradition. So we can recognize them in the different traditions. But the archetypes are our lineage. So it's the keeper of sacred space. The one who hears the cries. The advocate of the soul. The wise one. The liberator. The journeyer, meaning the capacity to move into the upper and lower worlds and the human world, the healer, and the beloved. And in that program also, there has been developed a model for group spiritual guidance so that one doesn't have to always be dependent upon a teacher being there, but there's a group spiritual guidance. So I feel like if you need three things, if you need the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha, if the Buddha is the teacher, then my definition of a teacher is a doorway. They open a door and they show you a doorway. And that's what I hope I've been doing. I like to say that the way I teach is I put out a buffet and you take what's the food for you at any given time in your journey. And also, there's a level of the teacher are all those figures that I mentioned in the beginning that have come into my life as the divine desire attempted to gather itself together and create this. There are a whole level of teachers that stream through me into you. But the larger level of our lineage are the eight archetypes. And that's why the model of peer group spiritual guidance is built on those archetypes. The conscious invoking of them, the creating of the space that they bring together. They're key pieces. In addition to that, I would add two other programs. The transition program, which many people have come through in the Northwest, which is really the study of how to live in liminality and enormously important piece, the in-between times, when we are both dying and pregnant at the same time. And then the soul of Christianity. And why I consider that a part of the school is it's a model. From my perspective, it's a model to how to look at any religious tradition as a path from the place of soul. And what do I mean by soul? I mean to encounter it as an inner path, and in which you encounter a path that's articulated by the archetypes that are contained in the central myth. So the core of the soul of Christianity that I teach, there are many other parts of it, but the core of what I teach is you take the words of Christ, I am the light, the way, and the truth. So if you take the way, I am the light, the Christian myth illuminates 14 archetypal experiences that are in the collective unconscious. It illuminates 14 key archetypes that create a path. So I am the light. The myth gives you those 14 archetypes. I am the way. The Christian way is to live those 14 archetypes. And you may live them several times in various ways. And the truth, if you follow that path, you will discover the Christ within you, and you will become the truth of who you are. So by taking one tradition, and of course it's my religion, I think of my path as the path of the beloved, and a universal aspect of that found in all the great traditions. But my religion is Christianity in the sense that that's where my root symbols are. That's where my root myth is. That's where the root archetypes are for me. The others I have encountered with great appreciation, but the Christian ones, Judaic Christian ones, are woven into the fabric of my being from early childhood. What I was never taught was Christianity as a path. And of course you have the great stream of Christian mystics and the new vision coming out of people like Teilhard de Chardin, the retelling of the Christian myth. So they're the key pieces in terms of the programs. And we have our international gatherings that have emerged. And Reb Zalman, unbeknownst to me, one day called me and said, I've been looking on your website. You've got the most unique combination. Nobody else is doing the same thing. Good work. Keep going. You know? Enormously helpful pieces. I had no idea he would actually look on my website, let alone give the response that he gave. Now, they're the inner pilgrimages, but I feel there's also the other half, which are the outer pilgrimages. And certainly, initially this was inspired by Pir Vilayat, but what I've discovered is the Dalai Lama, not in terms of his Buddhist practice, but one of his practices for the world we are doing. Because he said, I have three practices I do for the world. I study the great teachers of the different traditions. I visit all the sacred places of the different traditions. And I seek to be in some kind of dialogue with the people who do their deepest practices. So to me, these two pieces are also following a model of the Dalai Lama for this new consciousness that is emerging. So many people in this room have been to India with me. Why India? Because in Varanasi you can find the center of the Hindu world. Why in Bogaya? Because there you find the center of the Buddhist world. Why Jerusalem? Because there's the center of the Jewish world, of the Christian world, and the third holiest place in Islam. To go to the centers of the world has a certain transmission there that's incredible. Even if the place itself is crazy, the transmission underneath is profound. And two other places, there's many other places that I've led people to, but obviously Bhutan is my great love at the present moment. And that has much to do with Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, but also because it is described as the only intact Buddhist culture in the world. And I just long for people to experience what it is like to be in a culture permeated by loving kindness. I mean, we have people come on that pilgrimage who start crying because of the way somebody serves them a cup of coffee. With the openness and the presence that's so exquisite, it's so foreign from the world we've built in the West. And to feel that reality is extremely important, to know what that can be. That's not to say it doesn't have its difficulties and its shadow. Every place has its shadow. But that practice does permeate the culture, at least until now. It's living practice, living spiritual practice. And another key place is Assisi. Because Assisi, every tradition will need figures that retell the myth, that take it into the next consciousness. And St. Francis has now been claimed by the world. Like Rumi is claimed by the world from Sufism, St. Francis is claimed by the world. It is also where the Pope brought the first interfaith gathering in the history of the Roman Catholic Church, had the Dalai Lama and all these people come to Assisi. And you can see Pier Vilayat in the pictures. There's a book there about it, and he stands out, believe me, with his light. It has that history established, and when you go to where St. Francis's cave is now, they have a whole piece that has all the symbols of the different religions. And of course, he is, in the Christian tradition, the saint of ecology. And we have a saint who I think is going to transform the Roman Catholic Church as a living example, not by changing all the dots and commas, but by being a living example of what is Christianity, which is love, and love particularly for the poor. So I just have a few things to say. I really try to follow where the inspiration comes. And so walking down the street about a month ago, being very focused on this particular piece, all of a sudden it came to me, the next international gathering will be in Assisi. And I will lead a pilgrimage beforehand. I've led about 12 there. And then we'll do our gathering there because we haven't had one in Europe for about eight years. These have been such a full piece, and they're longing for it. So to put those together in Assisi would be an enormous gift, I think, for us all. I just also want to mention before we break, we have an extended family. So there are people here that have been very much involved. But the pilgrimage gives us also an extended family throughout the world. So who here has been to Bhutan and will ever forget Chimi, our guide? You can't forget him. You can't. He's part of our community now. Who's taken us through Bhutan, what, four or five times now? What come into our heart? We see the living reality of the Bhutanese Buddhist culture in him. Those of us who have recently been to India, who can forget Uma? Uma is a part of our life now. A European who's lived in Varanasi for 25 years. Those of you who've been to Jerusalem with me, you know the best Islamic teacher I have ever found. His name is Fatah, and he has a shop in Jerusalem that's no bigger than that little ware. So we all go into the shop because he will teach it from the heart. The living reality of a lived Islam without all the placed around it. And people go back and seek him out during the time of the pilgrimage just to be with him. And he, you know, his outer garb is a shopkeeper. I think of him as one of the Jewish tradition's 39 hidden saints. he's a hidden saint in Islam. If his experience of Islam could reach the world, it would change entirely how that tradition is seen. And certainly David Zeller was a piece of that. When we would go to Jerusalem, he would meet with us and sing. And a wonderful Sufi sheikh in Jerusalem, beautiful man who died a couple of years ago, right after we saw him. Enormously beautiful, originally from Uzbekistan. And to also say the woman who grew up is younger than me. She's about in her late 40s, who grew up in a village in Bhutan where there was no electricity. And she cried because when the night came, she couldn't do the weaving. She's keeping that piece of the soul of Bhutan alive. And so we always go to her weaving shop and hear about the journey with her. Someone who's now been at the Smithsonian Institute with her work. She's traveled all over the world. She has computers that she's working with. She lived where there were no phones, no electricities. She's lived centuries. These are part of our community. And someone I carry very deeply from our recent trip to India was a young man named Nidar. Some of you may remember him. And Nidar comes from an Islamic family. His best friend is Hindu. I met them together. At the age of 13, he started to support his family because his father developed a very serious illness. He's gained the money for two of his sisters to get married. And he said he thanked us and he thanked the other pilgrims coming to Bogaya because he said, I see a larger vision now. I see a larger vision of what the world is, a larger vision of what Islam can be, a larger vision of what the different religions are. So there's a cross-pollinization that takes place. And to me, the outer and inner world in each of us is essential, obviously, and a connection between those two, and the same thing with our inner pilgrimages and our outer pilgrimages.